Hey, everybody, and welcome to the June 2021 episode of Amplify. I'm your host, Sam Eshoo. This month, we're going to dive into syncope with a very special guest, Dr. James Morris, or Trey, as we call him lovingly. He is going to walk us through his article in Emergency Medicine Practice on the topic of syncope. But before we dive into that, I want to remind everyone out there of the Clinical Decision-Making in Emergency Medicine Conference being held this month, June 23rd through the 27th in Ponte Vedra. I really hope you can make it, and I want to see you there in person. I'll be there personally. But if you can't make it, clinicaldecisionmaking.com, there is a virtual option. I highly recommend it. You've already been reading all of the highlights from these faculty all year long, and this is your opportunity to see them live. And secondly, I want to also remind you, we announced last month some exciting news about EB Medicine and our new mobile app coming this summer. So keep your eyes on your email inbox about that special announcement and all the wonderful features that will be included in that. Both Emergency Medicine Practice and Pediatric Emergency Medicine Practice are outstanding references that you are already accustomed to using, and now they'll be available to you more rapidly in the mobile app. So can't wait for that release this summer. It has been a labor of love for the EB Medicine team and something that we're all looking forward to very soon. And now, here's Dr. Morris.
My name is James Morris, and I'm the Program Director of the Emergency Medicine Residency at the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center School of Medicine in Lubbock, Texas.
Wonderful. I really appreciate you being on the podcast with us today. And more than that, I appreciate you taking the time to author this month's issue in Emergency Medicine Practice on syncope. It is quite the varied topic. There are a number of things that can cause syncope, and I think in the entire issue, one of my favorite figures is actually figure one. It's sort of a pinwheel that starts with the center being low cardiac output or low peripheral resistance, and then works outwards towards a definitive diagnosis of cardiac syncope, reflex syncope, orthostatic hypotension, or drug-induced syncope. When we're looking at all of the varied things that can cause syncope, what's a useful way that you approach differentiating all the different types?
So I think that's really the challenge of what we face as emergency clinicians, because there are so many different factors that can lead to that final common pathway of low blood pressure with cerebral hyperperfusion, as you mentioned. This figure, I think, does a really good job of sort of conceptually dividing out what might lead you to those pathways. We obviously become most concerned about the cardiac syncope because this is usually the most immediately life-threatening. But in general, there's a lot of different things. Anything that essentially decreases your preload, decreases your cardiac contractility, can ultimately lead to syncope with cerebral hypoperfusion.
And I like in the article that you specifically said, if you're searching for a cause for syncope and you find it, then you're sort of leaving this algorithm. As the article progresses, we're increasingly focused on the syncope without a cause. So as we're searching through all of the different items that can cause syncope, once we actually make a diagnosis, say you have a massive PE, or you had an arrhythmia, or we have evidence for severe dehydration or something of that sort, then we can exit the algorithm and go treat that problem and not really worry about the syncope anymore as much as just treating the underlying diagnosis.
Absolutely. Syncope is really more of a symptom than it is a specific diagnosis, and it can be the symptom of a life-threatening disease. One of the adages that I ran across in my research said that syncope is the only difference between syncope and death is that you wake up from syncope. And so obviously there's a great deal of overlap there. Our risk stratification of syncope should really only occur if we have failed to identify an immediately life-threatening cause, such as GI bleed, pulmonary embolism, acute MI, subarachnoid hemorrhage, etc. Those are all things that can manifest with transient loss of consciousness, but are very, very different entities than syncope without an apparent etiology.
So let's start at the top. One of the things that's frequently puzzling is trying to differentiate syncope from a seizure as the patient is presenting in the emergency department, and we are in a place where we have to inquire about specific details on what people saw. People frequently think they're seeing seizure activity, but that may not always be the cause. How do we go about differentiating those two?
The real key is the history. And unfortunately, we're often not there and the patient was unconscious, so they're not able to provide a great deal of the history. So getting anything we can from bystanders to EMS, et cetera, will be very beneficial in trying to distinguish those. It's the case that patients often, or bystanders, lay people, and healthcare providers as well, often focus more on the movement rather than the loss of consciousness. And so things will be labeled as seizure, even though that's not actually what happened. Seizure, I think, is probably better conceptualized as an electrical storm in the brain that may result in motor activity. In syncope, the brain is being hyperperfused. And so while there can be some convulsive activity associated with it, it's typically briefer. And if you are able to get a reliable number of jerks associated with the episode, less than 10 would probably indicate syncope, whereas more than 20 is going to be more suggestive of seizure. The other big thing that's really, really helpful is determining if and how long any post-ictal period was present. As mentioned, you know, an electrical storm in the brain is going to leave the neurons sort of stunned for a period of time, you know, on the order of 15 to 60 minutes. Whereas with hyperperfusion, once you turn on the blood back to the brain is going to start functioning fairly normally again within a very brief period of time, usually seconds to a minute or so. And so if you're able to get that information, it can help you distinguish between syncope and seizure. It's interesting, some of the things that people typically rely on, such as urinary incontinence, actually don't wind up having much use in reliably distinguishing between those two entities.
Yeah, that is very interesting. And I also find myself frequently asking family members what they did when they saw that their loved one syncopized. And oftentimes they're holding them up or holding them in a chair in an upright position instead of laying them flat, and then observing the 30 seconds or sometimes even a complete full minute before the person's blood flow to the brain finally restores itself, and watching these twitches. And it can be a little nuanced teasing that out from people if it's not in your script to ask, oh, you watched your wife have a syncopal episode. What did you do? Did you allow her to fall to the ground? Oh, no, I caught her. So, okay. And then did you hold her up in a chair, or did you lay her down slowly and raise the feet? And no, I held her in the chair. I didn't want her to fall. I say, oh, okay. So she was upright this whole time while she was doing these little twitches you were watching. That can be a specific nuance you have to pull out of somebody, because they're generally not going to just be giving you that information up front without a little prompting.
Absolutely. And the longer the patient is kept from becoming recumbent, the more likely it is that the hyperperfusion is going to persist and result in some sort of motor activity. One of the other factors that may be helpful is that seizures don't typically develop in older adults out of the blue. And so if a young person has abnormal motor activity, it may be more likely to be seizure. But as they get older, it's probably more likely to be syncope.
And we're using, it looks like in the article, an age cutoff of about 45 years old. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Now, once the syncopal episode has occurred, family has called EMS and they arrive on scene, there is a lot of useful information that pre-hospital personnel can gather from the scene and from family before they transport the patient to the emergency department. What kinds of information are we looking for them to obtain?
The biggest things that we're looking for are the things that the patient themselves can't provide. And many syncopal episodes, unfortunately, don't occur with family members nearby. So the people who observed it won't be there in the ER for us to ask about things like, was there abnormal posturing? Was there abnormal head turning? How long did the episode last? Did they go to ground immediately? Did they have any sort of pallor or other unusual appearance before the episode occurred? And so those are all questions that can that the pre-hospital providers can obtain, which can be really, really instrumental in making the diagnosis. There was one study I read that estimated that when the diagnosis of undifferentiated syncope is made in the ER, about 90% of the time it's from the history and physical. And so the single most valuable test we have is sitting down and talking to the patient.
And then things that pre-hospital personnel can perform before arrival would be checking a blood glucose to make sure they're not hypoglycemic. I noticed ECG or pre-hospital ECG is in there, and a brief and focused neurological exam is in there as well.
Yes, there is some evidence that in cardiac causes of syncope, some of the arrhythmias may be transient, and the closer to the event that an ECG is recorded, the more likely we are to find an abnormality that we might be able to act upon. It's also helpful to be able to take that pre-hospital EKG and compare it to an EKG obtained in the ER. Of course, you know, it is an episode of altered mental status, so glucose is appropriate. Doing the standard assessment to make sure that they're not hypoxic, they're not tachycardic, they're not hypotensive, et cetera, is also important in the pre-hospital environment. We do expect people to be transiently hypotensive when they have a syncopal episode. So a slightly low blood pressure in the pre-hospital environment is not necessarily alarming, but we certainly want to make sure that it's not persisting.
And then they need to elicit if there's been any history of trauma, not necessarily like falling off a ladder or roof, although that's important, but more also regarding the syncopal episode itself. Did they fall in the bathroom? Did they hit their head? Was there any kind of CNS trauma as a result of the syncope or preceding it? Is that right?
Absolutely. And that becomes even more important as patients get older, because they are more likely to sustain injuries. There's some evidence that unexplained falls or loss of consciousness that results in fractures is more likely to be syncopal. And so they certainly want to make sure that they're doing an appropriate assessment of the patient and seeing if C-spine immobilization is indicated at that time, or if there's an injury as a result of the syncope that might be better cared for in a trauma center.
Okay, so working down the undifferentiated syncope, they have an uneventful transport to the emergency department. Pre-hospital personnel don't pick up any specific findings. The blood glucose is normal. The ECG was normal. They currently have no neurodeficits, and there was no involved trauma. And they make it to our emergency department, and now it's time for us to engage with the patient. When we start with the history, what kinds of things are we going to be asking the patient that would be helpful in the differentiation process?
Our first priority, I think, is to assess, are there findings either in the history or physical that would suggest that there is a life-threatening etiology of syncope present? So do you have chest pain? Do you have, you know, neurodeficit, shortness of breath? Are you hypotensive, abdominal pain? Are you bleeding somewhere, have a history of melena or other indications of a GI bleed? That's our first priority in evaluating the patient when they present to the emergency department.
And so that's looking at things like MI, GI, life-threatening GI bleeding, aortic dissection, ruptured AAAs, other abdominal catastrophes. So the major life-threatening events that we screen for normally in the emergency departments as a cause for the syncopal episode.
Absolutely. And just as people oftentimes will focus on the abnormal motor activity that might accompany syncope, sometimes people will be so focused on the loss of consciousness that they sort of minimize or neglect to mention the, oh yeah, well, I had some abdominal pain with this, or gosh, yeah, I have been bleeding pretty heavily, you know, in my period, or, you know, I had some chest pain with it before this happened, but they may not draw that to our attention unless we specifically ask for it.
And what about the elderly people in falls? So I'm seeing someone with your typical hip fracture from a fall. What kinds of tailored questions am I going to have to ask this person to differentiate, was this a syncopal episode or not?
So I think the biggest factor is, do they have a clear recollection of this being a mechanical fall? They were up walking, they tripped on the rug, they tripped over a step, and they recall everything on the way down. Patients that found themselves on the floor, I think we have to assume that there's a good chance that this might have actually been a syncopal presentation. And there's one study that indicated that perhaps even as many as 50% of unexplained falls in this group may be syncopal in origin.
Wow. So trying to find out if the person recalls the fall is critical. Discussing other associated symptoms that might lead us down another pathway, like the chest pain, the abdominal pain, the neuro symptoms, and then asking if they had any prodromal symptoms, all of that is encompassed in what we're going to ask for the initial evaluation.
If we feel that we've determined that there's not, at least based on the history and physical and immediately life-threatening cause that we need to investigate further, then we can turn toward examining the syncopal episode a little bit more specifically. And some of the things to ascertain in evaluating that is this something that's happened to them before? Maybe they have a longstanding history of syncope, and this is a very similar episode to what they've had previously. Do they recall any warning that there was going to be a loss of consciousness? Some patients will describe getting clammy, lightheaded, tunnel vision, roaring or ringing in their ears. Maybe they had palpitations. Figuring out if there were any sort of prodromal symptoms can be very helpful in determining whether or not this was syncope, and maybe helping you figure out what type of syncope they might have had.
Okay, so when we're done with our history and we've obtained answers to all of those questions, we're moving on to examination. There is a pretty heavy focus on vital signs, and appropriately so. We call them vital for a reason, but vital signs make a big difference. Is that right?
Absolutely. Patients with abnormal vital signs that persist upon presentation to the emergency department should not be presumed to have a low-risk etiology of syncope. And that's something that we sometimes maybe don't pay as much attention to, the tachycardia. We think, oh, well, they had syncope, so of course they're going to be hypotensive. But in fact, if they have persistent hypotension, that's a big red flag that there's something much more serious going on that we should not ignore.
Yeah, and additionally, hypoxia, even mild tachycardia, you know, pulse rates of about 100, all of those things can impact our differential and make a big difference in trying to determine whether this was just benign syncope. I did notice you mentioned orthostatic vital signs. Now tell me about that. There's been some debate about whether or not we should be doing these in the emergency department anymore. Do they still play a role in syncope?
So I think they do. I think the biggest risk with orthostatic vital signs is that we attempt to shoehorn a potentially serious cause of syncope into the relatively benign category of orthostatic hypotension. I think the major reason that we should be checking them is that one, it's a common cause, particularly among older people. We should be looking at medications, because medication-related orthostatic hypotension is a fairly frequent cause of syncopal presentations in the elderly. And it is one of the more modifiable risks or causes of syncope that we might see. If a patient's on a diuretic and they're having recurrent episodes of syncope, and we've never actually checked orthostatic vitals, we might prolong their exposure to the risk of a significant fall as a result of a syncopal event.
So there is benefit in performing them. We just have to be careful about attributing the diagnosis to orthostasis without having done a full evaluation.
Right. And that's when research has shown that patients with orthostatic hypotension may not necessarily have worse outcomes. And I think that that's why we have to be very deliberate in how we interpret the finding of orthostatic hypotension in an emergency department patient with syncope.
Now, you also mentioned carotid sinus massage, and honestly, this isn't something I typically do in my practice. So tell me more about why we should be adding this to our physical exam for the workup of syncope.
Sure. I think this is one of the more surprising finding was the strength of the recommendations by both the American Heart Association and the European Society for Cardiology. Essentially, if you have a patient that's over 40 years old that you've not been able to determine the etiology of syncope and you've ruled out threats to life, if there are no contraindications to performing carotid sinus massage, such as patients that are at high risk for stroke, that have had an MI in the previous 3 months or a history of ventricular arrhythmia, or complications from previous massage, then they actually recommend that we consider performing carotid sinus massage to establish the diagnosis of neurally mediated syncope.
And this is something that can be performed safely in the emergency department, or is this something we should be deferring to the outpatient setting during their follow-up visit?
So I think it's actually probably best accomplished in the emergency department because you want to make sure that you have appropriate monitoring and resuscitation equipment present, which may not be present in the clinical, in the office environment, for instance. Typically, you perform it just as you would for cardioversion of a patient with SVT. It's the same technique, and it's considered positive if they have syncope, asystole over 3 seconds, if they develop an AV block, or if their systolic pressure drops at least 50 millimeters of mercury. So any of those findings would be considered positive and would establish a diagnosis of neurally mediated syncope.
And those findings would be seen immediately after, if not during, the carotid sinus massage to make the diagnosis of carotid sinus hypersensitivity. Is that right?
Exactly. They would be seen basically while you're doing the carotid sinus massage. And you mentioned carotid sinus hypersensitivity. That's when, you know, there's some historical features such as syncope with shaving or turning your head that we always kind of classically think about. But this many patients unfortunately don't read the textbooks, and so this may be an opportunity for us to identify an etiology of syncope in the patients that we otherwise would miss and that could potentially be referred for other high risk or potentially invasive testing.
All right. So something I need to add to my physical examination for syncope, including table 5, the list of contraindications to performing these, which isn't necessarily as easy to remember as one might think. So high risk for stroke, including a recent TIA or stroke within the last 3 months, or known clinical carotid stenosis, or the presence of a bruit, or a history of peripheral artery disease or coronary artery disease. Certainly, I think a lot of our elderly patients will fit into these categories. And then complications from prior attempts at carotid massage, previous history of MI within the past 3 months, because potentially an increased risk of cardiac arrhythmias during the procedure, and a personal history of ventricular arrhythmias. That's quite an extensive list.
It is. And as you mentioned, there's sort of a window, you know, over age 40 until patients accumulate some of those conditions that will be contraindications. So it's not something I'm going to be trying in my 90-year-old patients. But for the young, otherwise healthy people in their 40s, maybe early 50s, it might be beneficial.
That's very helpful. And then we move on to our ECG. So we're going to perform an electrocardiogram on these patients, even if they've had one pre-hospital, so that we can at least do the comparison to see if there's been any change. But what kind of things are we looking for in the ED on ECG?
So that's actually a fairly controversial question, because in a perfect world, we'll get a completely normal EKG, normal sinus rhythm, no conduction abnormalities, no arrhythmias, no evidence of ischemia or any other unusual findings such as Brugada or epsilon waves, et cetera. That's the perfect world. If we don't get the normal EKG, then it becomes a lot more challenging because there is some controversy as to which findings are actually more likely to be associated with adverse outcomes. And that's where, for instance, curiously, the type 1 Brugada may actually not be as clearly associated with adverse outcomes, even though we always think about looking for it. There's some controversy as to whether or not that's actually a dangerous finding. But in general, any kind of non-sinus rhythm, if they have multiple PVCs, short PR intervals, any kind of AV block, even including first-degree AV block in patients with syncope, left bundle branch block, or any kind of ischemic findings are worrisome and may portend a bad outcome.
And when we talk about these findings, these should be new findings, correct? So for example, if I have an old EKG on this patient and they have the same changes a year ago and there's been no new change, does that exclude them from the high-risk category?
So I would say actually it does not exclude them, because the goal is that we're trying to identify patients with poor conducting systems. And that could be from a variety of causes, but if their cardiovascular physiology is such that they've already developed left bundle branch block, or they have non-sinus rhythm, including atrial fibrillation, even if it's not a new finding of atrial fibrillation, it's likely associated with worse outcomes.
Okay, so not necessarily a new finding, just the presence of these things on ECG may put them in a higher risk category.
Yes, that's correct.
All right. And then labs. So some of us may be working at a place where we already have a pre-built order set for, you know, syncope over the age of 40. But if not, and you're having to pick and choose, there are some things that are helpful and some things that might be helpful. So where do we start in this scenario?
So I think starting with sort of the more basic studies, such as your CBC, your electrolytes, renal function, and pregnancy tests, particularly in females of childbearing age, I think that's reasonable. Now, you can make the argument that for a young person with clear vasovagal syncope, those are not necessary. But I think if you're reaching the point where you have an undifferentiated syncope, those are very reasonably inexpensive studies that can sometimes help identify patients that might otherwise be missed. The other studies that might be useful include lactate if you're still trying to sort out whether or not this might have been seizure versus syncope. There's some evidence that an elevated lactate within 2 hours may support a diagnosis of seizure. And then the sort of more emerging or potentially controversial is the role of BNP or proBNP and troponin in the risk stratification of syncope. And that's something that it was interesting reviewing the studies from a fairly long time period to find that before the advent of high sensitivity troponin and the BNP and proBNP, there really wasn't a lot of utility in cardiac biomarkers. But as the high sensitivity assays became available, there actually did appear to be some prognostic value associated with those particular test.
Now, you mentioned the high sensitivity troponin. So if someone's working in an emergency department where they just have the standard troponin I and not the high sensitivity version, does that mean that the standard test is of less utility or no utility?
So I would say a positive result is still interesting and should change your management. A negative test may not be as reassuring as it would be if you had a high sensitivity study.
And then you mentioned in the article potentially doing a delta BNP or measuring it at presentation and then again after a certain number of hours. Is there utility to that?
I think that, that was an interesting study. It looked at BNP both at presentation and at 6 hours and found that an increase was more likely to be associated with syncope from ventricular fibrillation or ventricular tachycardia. And so I think if for whatever reason you have a syncope patient that you've not been able to clearly say this is a benign etiology, that I think they can go and they're in your ER or in a observation or other monitored setting at 6 hours, there may be some utility in repeating that, and a positive result would be certainly worth considering further. I think it's hard to say at this point that it's diagnostic of it, but I think it is certainly a little bit more smoke to add to the fire of a ventricular arrhythmia.
And it doesn't really establish a threshold for change in BNP that would be specific to ventricular arrhythmia. So we couldn't say if the BNP went up by 100 that that was diagnostic, but if it went up by 50 that it's not.
Right. It's not that well fleshed out at this point. I think it's something that further research is going to have to look at.
And then just for clarification purposes, we check pregnancy tests on women of reproductive age because we're looking for ectopic pregnancy as a potential cause for underlying syncope.
Yes, absolutely. And again, going back to the fact that patients will sometimes fixate on the loss of consciousness and neglect that, oh yeah, I had some abdominal pain beforehand. Also, this is a potential confounder, but sometimes patients with vagal syncope, which is of course more common in younger people, will also have some abdominal pain associated with it. And so that can make it a little bit more challenging, but certainly it's something that we want to avoid ascribing the abdominal pain to a benign etiology until we've ruled out that threat to life.
Okay, so I've got my list of labs there. BNP may be helpful depending on the situation. Same with the troponin, lactic acid, if I'm still debating whether or not this was a seizure. But the basics are there. So the CBC, the chemistry profile, the renal function, and the pregnancy test. And then we're looking at bedside echocardiography. So we are talking about formal echocardiography or the rapid ED version performed by me personally, or what kind of echocardiography are we discussing?
So in the studies, they were looking at formal echocardiography. And so I think that potentially, for instance, if a patient is hypotensive and you're doing a rush exam and looking to evaluate, the squeeze and things along those lines, I think that is certainly reasonable. It's just not something that's been formally studied in this particular setting. There are some things that predict a likelihood of finding abnormal echocardiogram, such as a history of heart failure, coronary artery disease, abnormal EKG, or elevated biomarkers. In the absence of those, it's probably not going to be tremendously helpful to obtain echocardiograms on your undifferentiated patient. Now, if you have a young patient with exertional syncope with Dagger Q waves on their EKG that you're concerned about hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, then certainly they may fall outside of that narrow list of predictors. But in general, if you have a patient with a relatively normal evaluation, an echocardiogram is unlikely to meaningfully change their disposition or prognosis.
Great. And then there's CT imaging. So when we talk about imaging, we have just plain film X-ray and CT. So let's begin with CT. Many family members will often, after having seen a family member have a syncopal episode, come in being concerned that there was something intracranial going on. We need a CT of their head. But what is the evidence behind this particular test and whether or not it's helpful in syncope?
So the evidence is actually very, very robust. We should not be obtaining CTs in patients with syncope unless there is another independent indication for the CT other than syncope. So for instance, a patient comes in, they had a syncopal episode, they awoke with worst headache of their life, they had a syncopal episode, they awoke with a neurologic deficit, had a syncopal episode, they're on anticoagulants and they struck their head. Absolutely, obtain CTs in those situations. But in the absence of those indications, I think it's important that we educate patients and families that this was not a brain problem. This is more likely a heart, a pump, a vessel problem. And the CT scan is only going to expose them to radiation without actually giving us additional information about what caused their problem.
Okay, so that's the brain. What about pulmonary angiography? So we're looking at CTPE studies for everyone who syncopized. I noticed the D-dimer didn't make it into the list of labs. So does that mean we're just going to automatically get the PE study, or what's the best evidence behind that decision?
So the best evidence for that is if you think you need to work up a PE, you should work up a PE. Yes, there is evidence that, of course, PEs can cause syncope, and that patients with syncope and pulmonary embolism have worse prognoses, but that doesn't mean that we need to indiscriminately evaluate every patient that comes in for syncope. Other risk stratification systems, such as PERC, actually do a very good job of ruling out PE in this population.
So I have a syncopal patient who is PERC negative. That person doesn't need a D-dimer or any CT imaging, but if they're PERC positive, then I could still go down the Wells pathway and get a D-dimer. And do my standard evaluation for PE. I don't have to alter it because of the syncope.
That's correct. And I think that's something that we sort of latch onto PE as being a very serious cause of syncope, but it's not a terribly common cause of syncope. And so patients that have a pulmonary embolus large enough to obstruct blood flow and result in cerebral hypoperfusion almost never will be PERC negative in the ER. And so that's something I think that if you have a person that's 50 or older that had syncopal episode, I think considering pulmonary embolism and restratifying using Wells might be appropriate. But for the vast majority, especially younger patients with syncope, the syncopal event in and of itself is not a reason to obtain a D-dimer in this population.
Yeah, this can be a little challenging, I think, especially for people who have a pre-built order set that includes many of these labs as an automatic order. I've seen cases where we get elevated BNPs or elevated D-dimers or an elevated lactic acid that's borderline. And we end up kind of scratching our heads going, well, I'm not entirely sure what to do with this information because it came before any kind of pathway or calculation of risk or consideration for risk before the result arrived. And so I think it's good to highlight that it's still important to run through that mental algorithm and decide on a risk level before you automatically order tests, because test results will come back abnormal and then the interpretation of them is going to rely on you having already performed that mental activity. And if you haven't done it already, it can be really muddying for the picture.
Absolutely. I think without knowing what the pretest probability of the condition we're looking for is, it's challenging, if not impossible, to accurately interpret a test result. When autopilot has been has already been initiated and we are presented with a series of test results, sometimes it definitely clouds the picture.
Okay, so let's move on to stratifying risk. So apparently there are quite a number of risk stratification tools, even more than I understood were out there, that you have wonderfully reviewed and summarized in Table 8. Now, what role are all of these tools going to play for us in the emergency department? Are there one or two of these that have actually been proven to be useful or diagnostic in the ED?
So that's a very challenging question to answer fairly, I think, because as with many studies, many clinical decision rules, when the originators test them, they perform very, very well. And then researchers from a different institution, a different region, start to look at them, they don't tend to perform as well. And with syncope, that's very much the case. You know, there's the old adage in medicine that if there's, you know, 10 treatments for a condition, then none of them are very good. Similarly, if there are 14 different clinical decision rules, then none of them are great. There's been a few that came out in the past year or so that I'm optimistic that if externally validated may actually be meaningful and achieve their goal of reducing admissions for patients. And those are the Canadian syncope risk stratification system and the FAINT rule. Both of those are fairly recent, though.
Yeah, I like in the table how you summarize the criteria and the outcome of the rule. I think it's important to highlight that when we're in the emergency department trying to decide if someone can safely go home, we're looking at a very short follow-up outcome or time frame in which the patient might have an adverse event. So it's important to me to know that in the 3, 4, 5 days, maybe even a week or two until this person can see their primary care physician and get that follow-up testing or evaluation done, that nothing serious is going to happen to them. And so some of these risk calculators measured outcomes as far out as a year, which isn't necessarily as helpful for me. It's good to know that they're low risk for a year, but I am really hyper-focused on the next 7 days and what's going to happen with this person then during that time frame. So I see that some of these scoring systems, they all vary based on their criteria, what the score cutoff was, and what the ultimate outcome was that they measured, making comparison really quite difficult.
Yes, and another factor that I thought was interesting is that some of the rules actually incorporate the clinician's estimation as far as what the etiology of syncope might be. For instance, patients that are presumed to have a vasovagal episode will be low risk or have points taken away that move them further away from being a high risk patient, whereas patients that are estimated in the ED to have a high risk presentation actually are pushed further towards the high risk end of the scale. I thought that was kind of an interesting phenomenon, how the rule sort of piggybacks on clinician gestalt.
Yeah. That can be problematic. If you're listening and you're not sure what we're talking about, sometimes that allows for some bias from the person who is performing the calculation. So if I'm the physician and I think, oh, you just had vasovagal syncope, this is really nothing, and that's a bias I already bring to the table, then when I open up the calculating system and it asks me, do you think this is vasovagal and pretty benign, and I put yes, if it weighs that highly, then it's not actually performing any kind of objective assessment. It's really more just validating the bias I already brought to this conversation. And though my opinion certainly has weight, the helpful scoring systems rely less on that and more on some objective data. And then it's helpful if they confirm what I already assume or the bias that I'm bringing. And less helpful if they're just relying a lot on what I'm bringing to the conversation before we even start the calculation. So that's why that particular element can be a little challenging in scoring systems. But I do think you did a really good job summarizing all of that data. I especially like table 7. This is the low risk and high risk features of syncope, which looks like it came from the European Society of Cardiology based on just the event, so characteristics that make it low or high risk, their past medical history, characteristics that make it low or high risk, and then their physical examination and ECG. It's a very nice table that outlines those abnormal and hopefully reassuring findings. I found that to be very helpful.
Yes, I thought that was an excellent presentation because one of the things you start to see is that there are clusters of findings that support a low risk or a high risk presentation. And so patients that are young, that are healthy, that have normal vital signs, that have a presentation suggestive of a vasovagal event, that have a normal EKG, et cetera, all of these kind of cluster around low risk, even if there's no one specific clinical decision rule that incorporates all of those elements. And similarly, older patients with significant comorbidities or those that have abnormal vital signs, those that have chest pain, shortness of breath, elevated cardiac biomarkers or abnormal EKGs, those tend to cluster as high risk. And so the table from the European Society of Cardiology actually did a really good job of putting that in a format that you can kind of see almost immediately how those shake out.
Okay, and before we move on to the disposition, so what we're going to do with this patient ultimately, there are a couple of controversies you highlighted. One we spoke about already, that's orthostatic vital signs, but another was the admission of elderly patients. So tell me what the controversy is there.
So I think that the, one of the things that we as emergency clinicians have in our mind is that if we put a patient in the hospital, we're doing something good for them, that we are changing their outcome, their prognosis in some way. And for syncope, that doesn't necessarily appear to be the case. So for patients in whom, elderly patients in whom a life-threatening etiology has not been identified, but who are high risk based on age or other risk factors, it appears that their long-term outcome is really related to their comorbidities, not to the hospitalization itself. And so that's, to me, I found that to be fairly interesting, that our reflexive, the patient is high risk for a bad outcome, we should put them in the hospital. Well, maybe that hospitalization actually doesn't do anything meaningful that's going to change their risk for a bad outcome. One of the other things that I think is reasonable to consider is that many of the risk stratification systems incorporate historical findings such as CHF, but there is some evidence that patients, even elderly patients or patients with risk factors by past medical history, can be safely discharged if their present syncope episode was related to a benign cause. And that's, again, with the elderly, one of the most frequent ones is medication-related orthostatic hypotension. Of course, they can also get dehydrated, et cetera. So there's lots of potentially relatively benign causes that could be potentially safely discharged from the ER, even if they have history of coronary artery disease or CHF, that the risk stratification systems would indicate should prompt hospitalization.
Yeah, you know, we talk a lot about shared decision making. I kind of feel like it's the hammer that's constantly beat into my head here in the last several years. But this is one of those areas where I have been surprised with what patients have told me. Even in scenarios where they've had a dramatic syncopal episode, if their entire ED evaluation is normal and there are no red flags and we're going through their risk stratification, there are quite a number of people who do not want to be in the hospital. And unless we have objective proof that the hospitalization is going to actually yield something important for the patient, their automatic set point is, I'm going home. Unless you can prove to me that being in the hospital is going to make a difference for me. And so this kind of information is helpful, especially when having, the conversation with the 70-year-old where we say, well, look, you have multiple medical problems, but actually the data shows even with that, if your ED evaluation is completely normal, the hospitalization may not reveal the cause. And here's the scenario wherein you have some high-risk elements or some high-risk features based on your past medical history, but nothing else is coming back abnormal. And now we're left with the decision of, do we need to put you in the hospital or can we send you home and have you follow up with your primary care doctor? And I've always been surprised with the number of people who just want to go home and want to avoid the hospital at all costs.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. Sometimes if the ultimate, I guess, end game of the treatment they might receive is not something they're indicated, they're not something they're interested in, rather, then there's really no reason to put them in the hospital. My kind of personal rule is that 90-year-olds can do whatever they want. If a 90-year-old comes in for a problem that it's reasonable to hospitalize them for, I'm happy to put them in the hospital. And if they have something that I think they need to be hospitalized for, but they want to go home, absolutely. I will defer to their wishes. It gets a lot trickier when you have the 58-year-old or the 67-year-old. But certainly as you reach the extreme of age, I think engaging that shared decision-making and just giving them the data they need to make the best decision for them personally is the right choice.
So when we talk about disposition, now that we've had this conversation with the patient, we've done our evaluation, you have broken down the disposition pathway kind of into three groups: the high risk, the intermediate risk, and the low risk, based on some of criteria and their past medical history. And the ultimate disposition there varies quite a bit. So walk me through that a little bit.
Sure. So I think the high risk patients, the ultimate high risk patients are those that experience syncope as a result of a ongoing life threatening condition. So the patient with massive pulmonary embolism, or the patient with EMI, the patient with a subarachnoid hemorrhage, those are very, very easy, straightforward decisions. The patients that have a undiagnosed syncope, but whose evaluation in the ED leads you to categorize them as high risk, those are ones that I think may benefit from a structured observation unit, observation pathway, either in an ED observation unit or in the hospital. And those again, I think, are very, very straightforward. We make that recommendation. That's at the other end of the spectrum, the low-risk patients, those are very simple as well. If you have a young person that came in that donated plasma and then had a syncopal episode, you know, give them some fluids and they can go home and everything's fine. It's the ones that have pretty benign evaluations, but some of the risk factors that put them in that sort of that gray zone that are a lot more challenging.
And then we're back into this kind of shared decision-making zone where we say, you know, you may or may not benefit from being in the hospital with observation, and here's this pathway we've established, but the cause still remains unclear, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think we have to be honest with the limits of our knowledge with patients that fall into that category, because Even now, with all of our testing and all of our research, many, many patients will fall into this category of undiagnosed syncope. And we just have to explain to them what is available, what testing might be reasonable and what testing might be likely to produce a diagnosis that would result in a change in therapy. And for many patients, that's a fairly limited list as far as what we're actually going to do. And if patients have good follow-up with their primary care doctor or with other, some facilities actually have syncope clinics or fall clinics that you might be able to refer your patient to, then in many cases, that's actually going to be a fairly reasonable option for disposition from the ED.
Fantastic. Well, we have reached the end. Is there anything else in the article that you think or you feel you want to talk about?
One study of pediatric patients with syncope, 58% received head CTs. And in that particular study, none of them had an abnormality. And so we've got to be much more judicious in imaging, particularly our younger patients.
Absolutely. That's a great point. Well, that's a wrap, everyone. Thanks again to Dr. Morris for a wonderful article and a summary for us on the podcast of syncope. Before we sign off, I want to remind you that this month, Clinical Decision Making in Emergency Medicine is taking place June 23rd through the 27th in Ponte Vedra. And I sincerely hope you can make it, but if you can't, there is a virtual option at clinicaldecisionmaking.com. And also, look forward to seeing the mobile app from EB Medicine this summer. That's it for me. Until next time, I'm your host, Sam Eshoo.